on rules for February 16th, 2010. For the purposes of the record, SDR 48A will not be heard today, and there will be no work session today. I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 1062. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 1062 requires imitation of ballot or sample ballot, outer envelope, and return envelope, if any, to specify that the imitation ballot or sample ballot is not an official ballot and not to be used to vote. We do have a -3 amendment, and it makes some changes regarding the back of the return envelope enclosed within the ballot, and the sample ballot shall state the following: this is not a real ballot, do not use to vote. The statement on the imitation ballot or sample ballot shall be printed in bold, that is at least 2 times as large as the majority of the text on the ballot or sample ballot, or 20-point type, whichever is larger. The statement on the back of the return envelope shall be printed in bold, that is at least 36-point type. You do have a statement from the League of Women Voters in your packet before you. There is a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the original bill.
Okay. Mr. Nelson, could you come forward also? Madam Secretary, could you start off?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Kate Brown, Oregon Secretary of State. Thank you so much for hearing Senate Bill 1062, and we encourage you to adopt the -3 amendments. The reason that I introduced this bill during a special session is that both myself and my elections administrator felt strongly that we needed greater clarity and objectivity in the current statute. The bill makes, as committee staff told you, 3 changes regarding language, location, and penalty changes. The bill will continue to protect the integrity of Oregon's elections process and will prohibit voter suppression. We did receive, during the special election, a couple of sample ballots in polling ballots in the actual ballots themselves. I realize that 2 ballots out of 1.3 million ballots is not a lot, but as a person who won her first race by 7 votes, I know that every vote truly does matter. And secondly, we are a complaint-driven process, not an investigative one, so folks have to come to us with their concerns. And so feel strongly that we need the language in this bill to provide greater clarity and objectivity. We met with Mr. Nelson early on. I think we have an agreement on the language on the -3, and I'd urge an aye vote. Happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel. As you know, there was a complaint filed in the 66-67 campaign about our simulated ballot. This is actually a methodology developed by Gallup years and years ago that we've been employing for about 25 years now. And in those 25 years, we have had discussions with the Secretary of State, the state's office, regarding the form and content of these ballots. During this last election, there was a fairly, as you remember, significant complaints and concerns raised. I met with the Secretary of State early on before the bill was, I think, actually drafted, and I appreciate that heads up. My concern with the original bill as drafted was the impact either both on cost with the red ink, which is part of the bill, and the concern about where it was placed on the original number 10 envelope, which I believe would have caused a reduction of response. I'd like to touch just initially about methodology, because this was also called into question with a complaint with the Secretary of State. In developing this product, what we do is we decide how many ballots we want to send out. Let's just do a round figure. Let's say it's 100,000. We actually did 110,000 this last time. We then take the entire voter file, and if I've got, let's say, I'm going to make 10 drops, I would do 10 drops of 10,000 for a total of 100,000. We do an nth every, say, 10th voter within that voter file to produce the 100,000 names. I emphasize this because part of the complaint was a belief that we had targeted certain geographical areas or certain age groups, which was certainly not the case. We don't do polling to get bad information. So it was a random sample, and then each mailing is divided up within each zip code 10 times. So we have random within random. So that's our process. The ballots go out at random, but they don't come back in at random. So we adjust those numbers when they come back in. We've given you a copy, an envelope of just how it looks. We've even gone from a pre-printed Nelson report to a typed return Nelson report, and this is an effort to increase our return. So our concern about big red letters across the front of this would have been, one, not just the cost, but what it would do to the return, because I think it would increase the throwaway. In meeting with Senator Devlin's office and the Secretary of State yesterday, we were able to come to an agreement in which that was deleted, and on the return envelope, on the back part of the return envelope, we would have the red letters with the language that you see in the bill. We do not believe that that hurts.
Not red. It'll be in black.
I mean, not red. Thank you. Black. Yes. And also, that would appear in larger type on the top of the actual ballot. So I appreciate the effort that has been made to come to this accommodation, recognizing that this is something we've done for a long time. It's not our intent to confuse people. And I think this will address that concern.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, in terms of the envelope, I felt extremely comfortable that folks would not mistake that for a ballot process, so we had no concerns making that change in terms of the language. And in terms of the red bold type, this statute also applies to educational efforts, so League of Women Voters or Classroom Law Project that are drafting sample ballots would have to do a two-color print type as well, making those educational efforts more expensive. So I feel comfortable that the bold and the size of the type will be adequate warning. If not, we can come back and revisit it in another legislative year, but I feel very comfortable that this will do the trick. So,
any questions for the Secretary of State or Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
On this little card here that came in there, it says that the Nelson Report has selected you as a representative of the average voter to mark this secret straw ballot. And, you know, when you talk about a secret ballot, did you consider having anything in here that this is a poll? I think people would understand that better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, and that was also a part of the criticism during the campaign. We did, although I don't think it's on, I think this was the original ballot. No, we did change. At the bottom of the ballot, where it used to say, simply place your completed ballot in the enclosed postage paid envelope and mail promptly, we did change that to completed survey. It's our intent to redo this piece in such a way that we try to get away from the word ballot. Also from the Nelson Report does not advocate for any particular measure, but I am, as you know, hired to run campaigns, so it's really semantics as to Nelson Report, Mark Nelson running the campaign, and which one am I advocating. So those are criticisms that we heard.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, we also explored in working on amendments last night whether we should craft language for additional pieces, and we just felt like it would get too complicated to have that in statute, so we didn't attach that issue.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Yeah, I totally understand that, but I'm just wondering if you considered you required that they say it's not a ballot. But I was wondering if you've considered having a requirement of what it really was. Is it a poll? Is it a informational piece? Or, you know, to say affirmatively what it is and not just what it isn't?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it's our intent to call it a survey. And we can say whether it should be survey or poll or but typically we use the term survey in describing our product.
Okay. Yeah, that would do it. Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Senator Farioli.
Yeah, following along the same line of questioning, are we calling arguments in favor, and arguments against, or are we still misfiling them in the voter's pants, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, my office is not the word police, and when folks submit voters pamphlet statements that appear to be one side or not the other, we call and speak with the crafter of the voters pamphlet statement, and if the person chooses it to be in the no column or the yes column, and that's where they want it to be, that's where it goes. We were involved with a little lawsuit with a fellow by the name of Bill Sizemore before I came in office over this very issue. So we are limited. In fact, we are prohibited in our ability to tell people what they can say and what they cannot say in their voters' pamphlet statements.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, to yes. Senator Farioli, at least we correct. It was actually my bill that corrected it, that they could actually call them and see if it was a mistake, because before there had been a case where someone had not intended that and it had gone in the wrong place.
Okay. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming here.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else to testify? Okay.
Thank you for trying to call.
Ms. Thompson and Ms. Easley, could you come forward?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Marge Easley. I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I wanted to commend Secretary of State and Mr. Mark Nelson on their compromise. I think that it's a good one. We support an election process that encourages maximum voter participation and ensures ease of ballot access and use. We therefore support SB 1062, and we are agreeable to the amendment that was proposed. We feel that it strengthens election laws concerning the use of imitation ballots that are mailed out to voters. It clearly spells out the exact wording and format of the language that must appear on both the outer and return envelopes, as well as the imitation ballot itself. And we feel that this is a substantial improvement over current law, and we feel that it eliminates any voter confusion that there might be. So we urge passage of SB 1062. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Janice Thompson, Common Cause Oregon. Also support the bill with the amendments and applaud the discussion that led up to the amendments. And I'm only here to kind of put this, I think, into a little bit of a historical perspective. I was doing this some other project that illustrated to me ways in which vote by mail sometimes requires the need to kind of take a look at existing election law that predated vote by mail. And I think that is one way to take a look at this bill. I mean, vote by mail, as you know, was adopted through the ballot measure process in 1998, but it had been in use in special elections prior to that, and most of the language replaced in 260.695, you know, predate vote by mail. So this whole concept of something along these lines, regulating a sample ballot, was in place. In 1999, there was the additional language about not for official use. I think that started a reflection of people seeing this sample ballot concept play out in vote by mail state, where it's not just potentially a sample ballot you're returning or maybe something you're taking into the voting machine. It's something that could be confused with an actual ballot, and that's, you know, a real problem in terms of just participation and whatnot. So just as there was a need for some update to reflect the vote-by-mail situation after some experience in the special elections in the 1999, legislative session. I guess I see this bill as just kind of a continuation of that trend. It's like as we kind of see more and more how vote by mail plays out, there's just the need for these kinds of updates. So just a little historical context in my view of this and your urging your support for the bill as amended.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrell.
Mr. Chairman, would this change also apply to any other local jurisdictions that might send a sample ballot? For instance, if a special district or a municipality decided to send a sample ballot, this would also apply to them.
Madam Secretary, do you want to come forward?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, yes, it would. Which is why we agreed to change the red to whatever type, so it would be one color and not two, so it would not be more expensive for folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. If I can get the gavel back. I will close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session for initially just for adoption of the Dash 3 amendments. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1062.
Okay. Senator Farrioli has moved the Dash 3 amendments to SB 1062. Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion passes. Committee members, we have an issue in the sense of we do not anticipate that the revenue or fiscal impact statements will change should this amendment be adopted. If they were to change, we can always bring the bill back to committee for further consideration. My other alternative is to wait till the statements come in based on the Dash 3 amendments and call the committee back in this afternoon to basically pass the bill out. What's the preference of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think you set an excellent precedent by waiting for the fiscals to arrive for consideration by the committee.
Okay.
Conversely, I think you set a bad precedent by moving bills to the floor where the fiscals are indeterminate.
Okay. Just for the record, we already do have fiscals for the bill, and we do not expect changes from the Dash 3, but I understand Senator Farrioli's concern. So we have the Dash 3 amendments adopted. I will bring the bill back once we have fiscal and revenue statements, and I'll close the work session. I'm going to go on to thank you very much. Those parties came here for SB 1062. I'm opening a public hearing on SB 1058.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1058 sets limits on amounts that may be received by candidates and political committees, permits local governments to enact contribution limits and prohibitions applicable to nominations or elections to local government office that are stricter than this 2010 Act, prohibits corporate labor and labor organizations, contributions directly from Treasury funds, and establishes civil penalties for violations to be imposed by Secretary of State or Attorney General, and repeals Chapter 3, Oregon Laws 2007, otherwise known as Ballot Measure 47. You have a Dash 1 amendment which replaces the measure, prohibits candidates from contributing to another candidate or political committee with monies from the candidates of principal campaign committee, and continues to repeal Chapter 3, Oregon Laws 2007.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 1058 and for also recognizing that the bill that we just had has the same relating clause, and happy to put it in the same bill. We are going to address just the Dash 1 amendment. The original bill, as printed, was a placeholder to meet the deadline, and so I will be addressing simply the narrow addressing of campaign finance that is in the Dash 1 amendment. As staff mentioned, the Dash 1 will prohibit pass-through contributions and the receipt of such contributions from one candidate political committee to another. Excuse me. Does not address any other committee. What it does say is that when Money is delivered to a candidate. At that point, it is intended for the use by that candidate and not to be passed on. Now, the legislation does not try to solve every problem with campaign contributions. It is narrowly crafted to address one essential component that impacts our democracy. Oregon citizens deserve to know that when they support a candidate with a contribution, that their money will not be passed to another candidate whom the donor may not even support. Pass-through contributions are essentially money laundering that serves to obscure the true identity of a candidate's supporters. Now, the legislature, we have often talked about various forms of campaign finance reform, but as a result of a recent ruling by the Oregon Supreme Court, we now have an opportunity to turn that into action. There are two exemptions in the Dash 1 as identified by legislative counsel based on federal law, and that is it does not prohibit a candidate from giving to a federal PAC or for a political committee that's organized for a measure. It is common for states to place limits on contributions to candidates from various sources and also on contributions to political action committees and political parties. Oregon is one of six states that does not have any limit on contributions. Seven other states have minimal contribution limits. Now, during the November 2006 general election, voters approved ballot measure 47, a statute that created campaign contribution and expenditure limits. Now, the Secretary of State, in consultation with the Attorney General, determined that ballot measure 47 would not be enforced as many of the elements were determined as clearly unconstitutional under Oregon law. And in fact, I will add, under a recent ruling by the United States Supreme Court, some other elements of Measure 47, which were assumed to be constitutional, are now no longer constitutional. Legislative counsel believes that limiting pass-through contributions may be upheld as constitutional based on the recent Oregon Supreme Court ruling in Vannata versus Oregon Government Ethics Commission, where the court distanced itself for the first time from its original Vannata 1 ruling, which declared that campaign contributions were constitutionally protected forms of expression, regardless of the ultimate use to which the contribution is put. And I want to read, Mr. Chair, from the court's ruling, which is the basis for introducing this piece of legislation. It says, first, the court's statement in Vannata 1 that campaign contributions were constitutionally protected forms of expression, regardless of the ultimate use to which that contribution is put, was unnecessary to the court's holding. On further reflection, we conclude that that observation was too broad and must be withdrawn. Second, because Vannata 1 assumed a symbiotic relationship between the making of contributions and the candidate's ability to communicate their political message, this court did not squarely decide in Vannata 1 that, in every case, the delivery to a public official, a candidate, or a campaign of money or something of value is also constitutionally protected expression as a matter of law. Now, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, when you go to the court, nothing is certain. But I will tell you, and one reason I'm bringing this forward is that for the first time in my 11 years in the legislature, to actually receive an analysis by legislative counsel that said on its face this could be considered statutorily constitutional, I think gives us a tremendous opportunity. In the Vannata 2 versus OGEC case, it was a rather remarkable ruling based on previous holdings under Vannata 1 and other holdings, whether it would be panhandling or new dancing, other areas of expression under Article 1, Section 9. This was for the first time in which the court was addressed an issue that, going into it, a lot of constitutional scholars, and you may have visited with some, who felt that the court would have to overturn the gift limit based on their previous discussion. And what they ended up doing was two things. Number one, they did protect it as a contribution, but they came up with a very unusual conclusion that the contribution, the giving of something, was in fact constitutionally protected, but that you might be able to restrict the receipt of it, that the transaction itself was not necessarily a free expression of speech. And as interesting as that was, it now brings us to the contribution, where may a candidate actually accept a contribution. Again, Mr. Chair, this is not intended to address all campaign issues. It does two important things. I think it gets to the one issue of when money is received to a candidate, is it an intent of that donor that that candidate be supported? It does not in any way limit contributions to anyone. You may continue to unlimited contributions to any candidate, any caucus, any political action committee, The caucus can still give money to anyone they want, but once the money is delivered to a candidate, it is assumed that the intent is to support that candidate and is for that candidate's use. The second thing, and I'll conclude with this, Mr. Chair, which I think is important, and was actually embodied in the same concept with the gift limitation, in which we fast-tracked a piece of legislation that I authored to get the court to rule on gifts, because of the fact that this could be considered constitutional on its face. And I might point out, and Legislative Council is here, this is one of the recommendations of the Oregon Law Commission a couple years ago, and even prior to the Van Atta 2 versus OGEC case, a number of the members of the Law Commission felt this particular limitation would have been constitutional at that time, much less with the expanded withdrawal as a result of Van Atta 1 on the acceptance. But for those who are really concerned about campaign finance reform, and whatever issue that may be, this is probably the first real opportunity that we can place into law, you know, one piece of campaign finance reform that would inevitably bring a challenge, and that would be a good thing. So finally get an opportunity for the court, now with their revision in Van Atta 1, to be able to tell this body what type of limitations you can have on campaign contributions. And as you know, you're never going to hear that unless there's something into effect that would go before the court. This would provide that opportunity to do that, Mr. Chair, and with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Questions for Senator Metzger?
Yes, Senator Atkins.
Senator Metzger, on your last comment about essentially passing this on hoping for a court challenge, in your opinion, how would that court challenge of this measure challenge the decision? Would it be your intent to challenge the decision that they made in Van Atta 2?
Well, it wouldn't be my intent, but I just assume, Senator, there's always going to be someone that would challenge any type of limitation on some basis, which would then present that before the court. I just think there's so many things that encompass campaign finance reform, and we all have different ideas of what might that be. But clearly, under the original Van Atta 1 ruling, most pieces of legislation that we have all seen are on their face unconstitutional. But we have a different ruling now under Van Atta 1, and I think this would be an opportunity to test that.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Additional? Senator Metzger, one of the things that I had suggested in terms of trying to test where the Supreme Court would go in this direction was to reinstitute the ban on receiving contributions during session. As you know, that's no longer enforced due to an Attorney General's opinion that's based on some of the previous court decisions you cited. What do you think of that as a method to basically put something before the court?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you know, I'm not an attorney and a legislative counsel as to would that have the same...
Senator Metzger, fortunately, we have no attorney.
Yeah, well, that's one of the good things about this committee. I think I would...
Except, Mr. Chairman, we do have four public relations specialists.
There we go, yeah. Which sometimes may be more important.
Or a lot worse.
Or a lot worse, depending on which, yes, absolutely. Mr. Chair, I don't know without hearing from Legislative Council as to whether that particular limitation, if it were to be forwarded, would have the same... compelling interest before the court or would narrowly fit the same Van Atta withdrawal, or it may or may not, I don't know. In my discussions with Legislative Council, we went this way because this one most paralleled the gift limitation of receipt of contributions. That one may as well, Mr. Chair, but I can't actually say that.
Okay. Anything additional? Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, I believe, two people signed up. Let's see. Norman Terrell and Janice Thompson. Mr. Nelson signed up for this also, but I think he was signing up for the other one. Please proceed at your leisure.
Senator Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Norman Terrell. I'm here today representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, which also represents men. I'm also a member of the National Board of the League of Women Voters, and they tell me I'm the first man to serve in that position. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League has long advocated improving election campaigns by limiting campaign contributions. The League believes that a comprehensive campaign finance limits similar to the original version of SB 1058 or HB 3009 of the 2009 session. The League is strongly in favor of the kind of limits on pass-through contributions like those in the amendment to Senate Bill 1058. Pass-through contributions are an insidious distortion of our campaign finance system because the original purposes of the contributor may be lost. However, this bill also repeals Measure 47, Oregon Laws 2007, Chapter 3, and the League would not be in favor of overruling a vote of the people of Oregon without at least replacing it with a comprehensive reform of campaign finance limits. The League believes this hearing on SB 1058 is an important step towards the needed comprehensive campaign finance limits. However, we do not believe we have enough time in this short session to adequately debate the needed reforms. So if I'm not clear, I want to make sure that you understand that we would be in favor of this bill going forward if you would eliminate the repeal of Measure 47 in that section. I think it would be a good test, in fact, of the new interpretation of Vannetta by Senator Metzger and Legislative Council. But we think Measure 47 needs to be replaced with a similar comprehensive approach to campaign limits. Thank you for the opportunity to provide our views.
Janice Thompson, Common Cause Oregon. We support the bill but I have some policy background to provide to kind of help everybody think that through, as well as some FYIs related to legal concerns and political considerations that I think if you're going to move forward with this as a test case, just good cautionary information to have, including information I shared already with Senator Metzger. So in terms of the policy, as you heard from the League of Women Voters, I would probably prefer the original version of Senate Bill 1058 because it was more comprehensive, including many, though not all, features of House Bill 3009 that I prepared and worked with in cooperation with the League on the House side last session. A comprehensive approach, I think, is preferred because campaign finance regulation is one of those topics where sometimes when you do one thing, you better make sure you do something else, or there's going to be problematic policy consequences. That said, if you're going to take kind of one thing and do it as a standalone, from a pure policy perspective, pass-through restrictions could probably work without, problematic side effects while achieving some of those transparency, greater clarity about, how the money is flowing and whatnot. And the other just piece of information is that pass-through contributions in Oregon legislative races has definitely been increasing over time. So this is, actually addressing something where there's some indication that it's a growing issue. From 1992 through 2006, as a percentage of total contributions to legislative candidates from leadership PACs and other candidate PACs kind of increased from about 12% in 1992 to a high of 29% of total fundraising in 2000, kind of leveling off to about 25%. So almost, 25% of money that's going to all the legislative candidates is coming in the form of these pass-throughs, including leadership PACs. So that's the policy background and why, from a pure policy point of view, if you're going to do one thing, you could kind of address some issues without necessarily setting off some of these unintended consequences that sometimes come in if you kind of don't do one plus something else and other topics on this whole arena. But the kind of cautionary concerns, one is legal. You know, because, as was mentioned, this came through as a recommendation from the Law Commission on a, you know, to do this on a standalone basis. At that point, due to questions about, you know, can't we just do this, I asked the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, which is where I turn to for legal input, as a, also a non-lawyer on all this, about if there were any legal concerns at the federal level. And they brought to my attention a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision overturning a standalone pass-through piece of legislation. And where the federal courts have upheld pass-through restrictions is when they are part of a comprehensive limits package. Because in that situation, you need them, or the pass-throughs are just going to become a way to circumvent the limits. So, you know, this is not exhaustive legal research. If you're going to kind of move forward on this, I might suggest some more legal research, because even in this dynamic, we're Senate, you know, we're now in this situation where Senate Bill 1058 could test Van Natta 1 and explore whether or not this, you know, we would need enabling constitutional language at the state level. The possibility of a federal court challenge just remains. And so, you know, just want to make sure that that is something that this group is aware of. And then the political consideration is that it links ballot measure 47. As an organization, the precursor organization, we're neutral on that piece of bill, on that ballot measure, in part because it also, even if it had been even if it had been enabled by its accompanying state constitutional amendment, it also included features that would have run into federal issues. That said, however, I think it's kind of hard politically for this group, for the legislature, to repeal a comprehensive package and only look like you're replacing it with pass-through restrictions. So I think there's the, you know, the political downside in terms of that this is implicitly repealing 47 along the way. So that's kind of the background information I wanted to make sure this had. I mean, I think it's, to me, it's a matter of deciding whether or not this is a good step, you know, a good Van Natta, what I call Van Natta 2 test case, both in terms of, you know, the legal dynamics, in terms of what it might trigger, in terms of possible federal court challenge, as well as the political dynamics.
Any questions?
I have one comment.
Yes.
I want to thank you for your testimony today, and I appreciate that very much, because I think both of your organizations and others have wrestled with this issue, probably will continue to wrestle with it for a long time. I guess the only comment I would make, and this is kind of, I think, where we get circular with things like campaign finance reform, is because whether it's at a state or a federal level, the concern about challenge, well, that's why nothing ever happens. And the only way you're going to happen is if you actually have the challenge. It's just like our gift limitation. Unless you actually say, okay, we welcome the challenge because that will help define the playing field. For those that would oppose, say, comprehensive campaign finance reform, the easiest way out is, well, it'll probably be challenged, so why bother? I would argue that that actually is the objective, when the court has the final say, is to provide something where the court may be in a corner and they have to then take the issue up and tell us what we can do. And so I appreciate your testimony very much, and whether we move forward with this or not, I would say to others, since I'm going to be leaving the group here soon, is I would just say that this is something that we're going to have to identify a particular piece in which, on its face, the Secretary of State can, in fact, put into law in order to get the kind of challenge, whether it's federal or state, for those who really want comprehensive campaign finance reform, to get a court to be able to give us some guidance on it. In lieu of that, I think we will continue to have good discussions and a lack of action, because this will at some point involve a court, and the court isn't going to address something unless they have to. So, thank you.
Anything additional? Thank you very much.
Okay, I will close that public hearing.
I wouldn't think so, Ted.
And we will take a 5-minute recess to get up, set up for executive appointments and to give the audience the time, unless they want to listen to 15 interviews by telephone.
Is everything by phone today?
Yes.
Reconvene the Committee on Rules for Tuesday, February 16, 2010, and begin and open a public hearing on appointments by the Governor. And we'll begin with hearing the appointees for the Trust for Cultural Development Board, Kathy Degendorfer, John Cruz, and Lee Weinstein.
Okay. Let's get the person back on the phone.
That's right. It's dead.
I just tried to get a hold of Ron. I had talked to him earlier because I'm 2:30.
Hello, this is Senator Rick Metzger with the Committee on Rules. Is this Kathy?
It is. Good morning.
Kathy, welcome. And just state your name for the record and give us a minute or so about why you would like to serve on the Trust for Cultural Development Board.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. My name is Kathy Degendorfer. I reside at 70300 Camp Polk Road, Sisters, Oregon, zip is 97759. I'm a native Oregonian, dedicated to the people of Oregon. I believe in the creative spirit and see it as a defining part of being an Oregonian. I believe our future depends upon nurturing and honoring creativity, so it's important for me to preserve cultural resources and increase public cultural participation across the state. Personally, I have been working in Central Oregon for the past 12 years, supporting artists, writers, musicians, and performance art. I developed a business called Sisters Artworks, which is a community arts accelerator here in Sisters. I'm a trustee for a private family foundation called the Roundhouse Foundation, which is dedicated to economic development through the arts. And that has brought me in touch with many interesting cultural organizations. And also my participation on the board of the Regional Arts Council has given me a pretty broad perspective on the needs of the region. So in summation, I believe that additional representation for the east side of the state is needed on the Cultural Trust Board, and I am willing to serve in that capacity. So thanks for the opportunity to answer any additional questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Degendorfer, and thank you for your willingness to serve. Any questions from the committee? We will be taking action on your appointment after we have gone through all the public hearings today. And thank you so much for your willingness to serve.
Thank you very much.
Okay, goodbye.
Good morning.
I'm going to John Cruz. Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Cruz.
Yes, please. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Senator Metzger sitting in for Chair Devlin and Senator Farioli on the Rules Committee. And if you would just state your name for the record and give us a brief summation of why you would like to serve on the Trust for Cultural Development Board.
Very good. Thank you very much, Senator Metzger. John Cruz, K-R-U-S-Z. Address is 2514 Northwest Westover, Portland, Oregon. And as stated, I stand before you as a candidate for Commissioner for the Oregon Cultural Trust. Very interested in serving, having spent a fair amount of time serving in my local community here in the Portland area with activities varying from board chair and president for the Portland Baroque Orchestra or a Multnomah County Library Advisory Board commissioner or running the library campaign in 2006 or currently serving as the chair for the Oregon Dew Foundation. So, very, very passionate about local arts and local culture. I look for the opportunity with the Cultural Trust Board to be able to expand my ability, hopefully, and capacity to serve to the greater state, not just my, you know, again, local Portland neighborhood, as it were.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Is there any questions from any of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Cruz. We'll be taking action on your appointment later in the meeting after we have heard from all of the appointees. Thank you for taking the time.
Very good. Thank you very much, Senator Bester.
Thank you.
And Mr. Weinstein.
Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Weinstein?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. This is Senator Rick Metzger and Senator Ted Farrielly, members of the Senate Rules Committee. If you could briefly state your name for the record and a brief summation of why you would like to serve on the Trust for Cultural Development Board.
Great, you bet. My name is Lee Weinstein, and I'm a resident of the Dalles, Oregon, and a native Oregonian at that. And I am honored to be nominated for the board. My interest is really in helping preserve and enhance Oregon's arts and culture. I was very involved with the sesquicentennial celebration, and I see this really as an extension of those efforts that I know Senator Farrielly helped very much in.
Did we lose you, or did you just...
He just paused.
He paused.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Weinstein, I appreciate your willingness to serve. Any questions from Senator Farrielly?
Mr. Weinstein, thank you for your service on the Oregon Sesquicentennial Committee. I have great expectations of you. I just want to warn the folks on the commission that you are one person who will uphold community festivals as being culturally valid, including activities like rodeo.
Absolutely.
So I hope that you will be a bridge to the folks in the commission who may not get as much exposure to Western culture as they might. But coming from the Dalles, which is a 10,000-year-old crossroads of culture, I know you're going to do a great job.
Well, thank you. I'm a big supporter of rodeo. Go to the Roundup. Actually, we've been the last 2 years in a row, and go to the Chief Joseph Days every year. And also was tried to be of help here with Fort Dalles Bay Rodeo, and that their grounds are changing, helping them secure some locations in the interim. So absolutely, you'll count on me for that.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. We'll be taking action on your appointment after we have gone through all the appointees today. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Great. Thank you, sir.
We'll close the public hearing on the Trust for Cultural Development Board and open a public hearing on appointees to the Oregon Medical Board.
Mr. Kopetsky.
Members of the committee, thank you very much for having me speak today. My name is John Kopetsky, for the record, and my address is 48903 Cayuse Road here in Pendleton, and I'm seeking the membership of the Oregon Medical Board for the public member position. I believe that my experience as former chairman of the Ethics Commission and the work that I've done on the bottle bill has kind of provided me some experience and background, and being from Eastern Oregon, I hope to continue to provide that good experience to the medical board.
Thank you, Mr. Kopetsky. Questions from the committee for Mr. Kopetsky. Mr. Kopetsky, thanks for your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment after we have heard all the appointees today. Thank you very much for taking the time to call in.
Well, thank you for calling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Mr. Koval.
Mr. Koval. Mr. Koval?
Yes.
Hi, this is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee, and if you would state your name for the record and give us a minute or so about why you would like to serve on the Oregon Medical Board.
Senator Metzger and members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to testify today. My full name is George Koval. I'm a resident of Cedar Mill in Washington County. I've been nominated to the Oregon Medical Board. I'm a practicing gastroenterologist with the Oregon Clinic. For the last 20 years, I've served as chairman of the Credentials Committee of Providence St. Vincent Medical Center, responsible for more than 1,800 members. I'm also in the Portland Service Area, which is a Providence Regional Credentials Committee, which serves some 4,000 physicians. During my 20 years as Credentials Chair, I've gained considerable experience in the evaluation of physician competence. I'm also a former member of the Legacy Health Systems Institutional Review Board Research. In that capacity, I gained additional experience in the ethics of physician-patient relationships. Obviously, I have a strong interest in this area, and I hope to bring this interest to the Oregon Medical Board. I was encouraged to do so by Kathleen Paley, the executive director, by John Evans, who is the incoming president of the Oregon Medical Association. I'd be happy to answer any questions about my experience or interest.
Thank you, Mr. Colwell. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Colwell? Well, thank you very much for your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment later this morning after we have heard all the appointees today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on the appointments to the Oregon Medical Board and open a public hearing on appointees to the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery.
Ms.
Armstrong. This is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. If you would please state your name for the record and give us a minute or so about your desire to serve on the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery.
Of course. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Lucina Armstrong, and my address is 4830 Southeast Boise Street, Portland, Oregon, 97206. I am greatly looking forward to serving the public as a member of the Direct Entry Midwifery Board. I'm passionate about ensuring that direct entry midwifery is properly regulated and that appropriate practice guidelines exist so that women who exercise their right to choose out-of-hospital birth with a licensed midwife will receive professional care and experience safe birth outcomes. My career has centered on serving as a health advocate for women and families with diverse backgrounds, and I'm committed to being the voice of those populations of women in Oregon who are currently underserved and experiencing poor maternal and baby outcomes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Armstrong? Hearing none, Ms. Armstrong, thanks for your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment later this morning after we have heard from all the appointees.
Thank you so
much.
Thank you. Bye.
Mr. Properzio?
That's right, Dee Properzio.
Thank you for joining us today, Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. If you could state your name for the record and give us a minute or so about why you would like to serve on the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery.
My name is James Dee Properzio. I live at 405 Harrison Street in Ashland, Oregon. And I am interested in serving on the board. I know you've already read my materials, but in essence, I think that I'm in support of informed home birth, and that I think it makes sense for the state to liaison with those practicing it by licensing, or by certifying, I should say, direct entry midwifery.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Mr. Properzio, we appreciate your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment after we have heard from all the appointees this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Close public hearing on the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery and open a public hearing on appointees to the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board. Mr. Bride.
Good morning. Mr. Devlin.
This is Senator Metzger filling in for Senator Devlin with the other members of the Rules Committee, and we appreciate you joining us today. If you could state your name for the record and give us a minute or so about why you would like to serve on the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board.
Certainly. Good morning, Mr. Metzger. My name is Peter Bride. I live at 2535 Northwest Inlet in Lincoln City. I'm the division manager for Liberty Homes Incorporated, Sheridan Division. I've been working here as the division manager for the last 5 years, and 25 years prior to that in other capacities. Interested in serving on the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board. My work experience has exposed me to facets of manufacturing, and feel I can contribute to the board's efforts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bright. Is there questions from the committee? If not, Mr. Bright, thank you for joining us. We'll be taking action on your appointment after we have heard from all the appointees this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Holtberg.
Good morning.
This is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. And if you would state your name for the record and give us a minute or so about why you would like to serve on the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board.
Thank you. My name is Larry Holtberg. I live here in Salem, Oregon. I'm a native Oregonian. And I represent the manufactured housing industry. Currently, I am associated with Home Builders Northwest, which is an independent Oregon-owned and operated builder here in Salem. I have about 20 years of experience in all aspects of the manufactured housing industry. I am a licensed manufactured home installer and contractor, and I've served at the Oregon State Building Codes Division on different committees and planning groups to develop rules and regulations. I would like to represent our industry on this committee to help provide solutions for Oregonians where you have a genuine need for affordable housing, and especially in today's economy. And I think that this provides a viable solution for many people, and we'd just like to represent the industry and have that voice that may have some impact on Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Holtberg. Is there any questions from the committee? If not, thank you, Mr. Holtberg. We'll be taking action on your appointment later this morning after we have heard from all the appointees today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Right.
We'll close the public hearing on the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board. Senator Atkinson.
Point of concern.
Point of concern.
People who live in Salem, close to the Capitol, should come in for the hearings. Thank you.
Thank you for that point. We'll open a public hearing on the appointment of James Ford to the Board of Directors of the State Accident Insurance Fund.
Okay. We skipped over him.
We're going to skip over him.
So
we'll close the appointment of James Ford, Board of Directors of SAFE, open a public hearing on the State Board of Tax Practitioners, Margaret Atchison.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Atchison?
Yes.
This is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. Thank you for joining us this morning. If you could state your name for the record and just give us a quick minute or so about why you would like to serve on the State Board of Tax Practitioners.
Okay, my name is Margaret Atchison. I'm a mortgage agent, licensed tax consultant. And the reason I'd like to serve on the Board of Tax Practitioners is because I think I can be a very good asset. I have served as a director on other boards in Deschutes County. And I'm a believer in their mission of protecting the consumer. To me, that's what I see coming into my office, is people with a lot of errors on the returns or mistakes. And I think if we keep up the education and the licensing, it really enhances the consumer of the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Atchison? If not, thank you for joining us. We'll be taking action on your appointment later this morning after we have heard from all the governor's appointees.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on the State Board of Tax Practitioners. Are we moving to the Tourism Commission then, or which one are we going to?
We got Mike. Tourism?
Jeffrey Constant.
Thank you.
law audit.
Ms. Audette? Ms. Audette?
Yes?
This is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Would you just state your name for the record and give the committee a minute or so about why you would like to serve on the Oregon Tourism Commission?
Excellent. I'm Alana Audette, the President and the CEO of the Central Oregon Visitors Association. Our address is 661 Southwest Powerhouse Drive, Bend, Oregon. And it is certainly a privilege to appear before you today. I wish I could be there in person, but thank you for allowing me to call in. And I've served as the CEO of the Central Oregon Visitors Association for more than 17 years. During that time, I've been very actively involved in the tourism policy development and execution of those programs, not only for Central Oregon, but through my activities and related service at the regional, statewide, and national tourism levels. And I believe I bring to the Oregon Tourism Commission a really well-balanced perspective and a very strong expertise in tourism marketing. I also have a solid background in legislative policy because my career path included about a decade of work in the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. And that background established a very strong foundation in national policy development, and I believe that those skills will serve me well on the Oregon Tourism Commission. My family background is in the hospitality industry, so I have a good balance of both the grassroots and the global perspective on the industry. I've got a tremendous amount of respect for the work that the Oregon Tourism Commission does. I appreciate the efforts of the staff there. They are top-notch, and I believe it would be a privilege to serve. So I wanted to thank you for your consideration, and I'm open to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Ms. Audette. Is there any questions for Ms. Audette?
Just a comment.
Senator Atkinson.
You have an absolutely impressive resume and biography, and thank you for your willingness to serve on this commission.
Well, thank you very much.
Further questions or comments? Well, thank you, Ms. Audette. We will be taking action on your appointment as soon as we have heard from all the governor's appointees, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Excellent. I appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to hearing back from you.
We'll close the public hearing on the appointment of Alana Audette to the Oregon Tourism Commission, and we open a public hearing on the appointment of Colleen Robertson to the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board.
Okay.
Ms. Robertson.
Yeah,
of John Day.
There you go.
Oregon.
Ms. Robertson.
Yeah.
This is Senator
Rick Metzger.
Yes, Senator Metzger and members of the Rules Committee, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
If you could just state your name for the record and give us a brief moment about why you would like to serve on the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board.
Right. And I am Colleen Robertson. My address is 59989 Highway 26 in John Day, Oregon. And communication with individual clients forms the foundation of my job as a veterinarian. Likewise, across the state, the Practice Act and the Veterinary Medical Examining Board comprise the foundation for our profession. Given the diversity of our state, I hope to add my voice as a rural veterinarian to the board. And I just thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you, Ms. Robertson. Questions from the committee? Okay, we have no questions, so that's a good sign. We'll be hearing from other appointees, and then we will be taking action on your appointment. And thanks so much for your willingness to serve.
Well, thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board and open a public hearing on the appointments of William Little and Diana Team to the Oregon Volunteers Commission for voluntary action and service.
Mr. Little.
That's big time.
Mr. Little.
Yes, good
this is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. If you could please just state your name for the record and give us a minute or so on why you would like to serve on the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service.
Okay, I would be happy to. My name is William Little, and I'm 58 years old. I have been a volunteer since I was in my late teens. I was a Peace Corps volunteer out of college, and I find that volunteer service, I think, for the community is very important. I mean, it's good for the individual. I think it's good for the community. And frankly, I think we're in a time now where there are a lot of communities are struggling with a variety of issues. I currently serve on the boards of several organizations in Southern Oregon. And I feel that there's a strong need, and I very much enjoy doing volunteer work, particularly with kids. So
Thank you, Mr. Little. Is there questions from the committee?
Actually, I do not have any questions.
But we might have some questions for you.
That's fine.
Are there any questions for Mr. Little? All right, we've completed the loop. Mr. Little, thank you for your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment after we have heard from all the governor's appointees this morning.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Ms. Team.
Ms. Team?
Yes.
This is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. If you could...
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'm Diana Team of Newport, Oregon.
Thank you.
And I'm a program advisor for Community Services Consortium, the community action agency for Lynn Benton and Lincoln Counties.
Great. Could you just give us a minute about why you would like to serve on this board?
I'm looking forward to serving on this board. I believe my background and experience as a director and chief development officer for nonprofit organizations will allow me to contribute to the commission in a meaningful way. I have been very fortunate in my career to witness firsthand the positive impact of volunteers. I've served as a volunteer in one form or another for most of my life. I understand the essential role volunteers play in our communities. The impact volunteer organizations can have is significant. Volunteers strengthen our communities in so many ways, as mentors for our youth, enhancing our education and healthcare systems, building parks and trails, increasing public safety, and so much more. I strongly believe in volunteerism, and I'm honored to serve the state of Oregon and support Oregon's volunteers.
Well, Ms. Team, thank you for your willingness to serve, and I know it's well received by all members of the committee who, for all intents and purposes, are also volunteers in most cases. So, are there questions for Ms. Team? Thank you very much for your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment shortly after we have heard from all the governor's appointees.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing on the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service and return to opening a public hearing on the Board of Directors of the State Accident Insurance Fund, Mr. James Ford. Mr. Ford.
Good morning.
This is Senator Rick Metzger and members of the Rules Committee. We appreciate you joining us this morning. If you could state your name for the record and give us a summary of why you would like to serve on the SAFE Board of Directors.
Thank you, Senator Metzger and members of the committee. My name is James M. Ford. My address is 507 Tucker Street, Ashland, Oregon, and I'm the CEO at Premier West Bank. My interest in serving the SAFE is to ensure the financial health of the SAFE activities for the state of Oregon and for business in Oregon. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions for Mr. Ford. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Jim, this is Senator Atkinson. I don't think I can let you off that easy.
Good morning, Senator.
Is this recommendation to serve on this board ensure that the transition between you and Mr. Anhorn will be smooth and he will parlay all of his knowledge to you?
He's interested in doing that. I've had extensive conversations with the CEO at SAFE, and she thinks that can happen. We're certainly looking forward for a smooth transition.
Well, I'm thinking this is about to become the official Premier West seat, but I look forward to your success.
There you go.
Thank you, Senator. Is there further discussion? Mr. Ford, thanks for your willingness to serve. We'll be taking action on your appointment after we have heard from all the governor's appointees.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll close the public hearing on the appointment of James Ford to the Board of Directors of SAIF. And members, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on the Residential Manufactured Structures Board because someone has just shown up who would like to testify. Mr. Bell, if you want to come forward. If you could state your name for the record and we have two different appointees, Mr. Bride and Mr. Holtberg, and to which one that you would be addressing would be helpful.
Both.
Okay.
My name is James Bila. I'm president and founder since 1991 of Oregon Earthquake Awareness, and I've been attending Building Code Board since 1991, including the Residential and Manufactured Structures Board. Apologize, I just got here. Have these appointees been interviewed by the committee?
They have. We're all finished.
Oh. Um, Well, I've given you four items, kind of a historical base, but maybe we'll start with the most recent one, the Appendix F radon control measures. If you go to the BCD website and look at the Oregon building codes, you will see that Appendix F, it says not adopted by the state of Oregon. And this is just an example of a national model building code that is weakened when it's adopted into Oregon. Now, the appendix, there's another appendix for grading measures. So the appendix are in there. Once they're adopted by the state, then they're not required statewide, but they're available for local jurisdictions or counties to employ. And this is just an example. We're in this kind of strange situation where now we have legislation to adopt radon resistive construction standards in Oregon. And for something I don't understand, it's being directed to this Residential Structures and Manufactured Structures Board, the very people who deleted it without any justification or statement. So I'm really recommending that you not fill these positions, that if you look at the history of this board, you'll see a continual weakening of the basic underpinnings of earthquake safety for the state of Oregon, particularly that I've been following.
Thank you, Mr. Vila.
Well, do you have the radon control?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's the latest example. In the January 21, 2004, I went to Senator Byer's committee and specifically testified against these appointments, Mr. Raymond Miller and Mr. David DeHarpo.
Go ahead, you can continue.
Please proceed.
And
because they paid a prime, they were the main force between implementing a seismic zone 4 at that time on the entire Oregon coast. I was the public force behind upgrading the building codes in Oregon for earthquake measures. But recently, Mr. DeHarpour, who's vice chair of this board, suggested that maybe we should not adopt the next edition of the National Model Building Code in Oregon. He cited that had been delayed by Minnesota. There's the current issue of the International Residential Code has required sprinklers in new construction, and it's been a kind of a political battle on building codes, but those states that don't want to have to implement that, some are suggesting that they not just adopt the next edition of the code. So this is a continuing problem on this board to set the public safety aside. If we get up to 2008, I see Senator Richard Devlin was the chair at that time, and I opposed the previous appointment because I didn't think there was enough information on the application to show that they had experience in actually code matters. And that's one issue I would raise with these two appointments. It's not the problem that develops on this board is it becomes just a rubber stamp. Everybody just votes unanimously. Nobody raises a question. When the boards were changed from monthly meetings, they became a quarterly meeting. Sometimes the building codes division cancels the quarterly meeting, which they're required to have by statute. So people aren't asked the hard questions that want to serve on these boards. Do they understand the building code? What about the issue of the major issues that have come into the code recently, the foundation plate sill anchorage that was just, there's been a code change nationally, but when will that be implemented in Oregon? Would they support not developing, not adopting the current, most current code, waiting another 4 years, hoping that the political answer on the national level will change? There's a fundamental problem which goes to the heart of the building codes division, and that's a total disregard for the public meetings law. They're fond of secret meetings, particularly with the Oregon Home Building Association, who has been talking to them. They're in favor, I've heard, of not adopting the next code. So I think, if I could summarize, it's best to leave these positions unfilled until pressure is put on the Building Codes Division to explain why they are weakening the Oregon Building Code below the national standard, which is a minimum. And when you go below the minimum, I don't think it's the minimum.
Anything else?
Well, the crux of what happens with these boards is they rubber stamp code changes. And the problem has always been that the code changes weaken the code and do not... They're basically alternate methods. Senator Atkinson, if I had a new product and you were a building official and I wanted to build a home with that new product, I would have to prove to you that my alternate means of construction was the equivalent in safety and performance and everything else. But what's happening is, I'll give a good example after the North Ridge earthquake. Because foundation sill plates split, they required that you put a 2.25 by 2.25 inch square plate washer on top of the sill plate and underneath the nut. Well, Oregon kept that out of the building code for 9 years, something that would have cost the homeowner initially maybe $6 or equivalent of a couple of three-wick bulbs. So that's the crux of the issue. They just changed the code. There's no justification, technically, for something that's not equivalent. It's just political. It's what people want. So I don't think things are going to change, but it's certainly not going to be changed by just adding two more people to a broken system.
Thank you very much. Is there any additional questions? Okay. Thank you for coming this morning. Okay, I will close the public hearing. Okay. I'm opening a work session and moving the following appointments to the following boards and commissions to the Senate floor with a to-be-confirmed en bloc recommendation. Kathy Dagendorfer, John Cruz, Lee Weinstein to the Trust for Cultural Development Board. John Kopetsky, George Cavall to the Oregon Medical Board. Lucina Armstrong and James DePuperzio. To the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery. Peter Bride and Larry Holtberg to the Residential and Manufactured Truck Structures Board. James Ford to the Board of Directors of SAFE. Margaret Atkinson to the State Board of Tax Practitioners. Colleen Robertson to the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examiners Board.
William Little and Diane Team to the Voluntary Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. Is there any discussion? Yes.
You skipped over the Tourism Commission.
We're going to do separate.
I said, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional discussion? Any objections? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Okay, I'm opening a work session and moving the following appointment and reappointment of Alana Audette to the Oregon Tourism Commission to the Senate floor with the B2 confirmed en bloc recommendation. Any objection? Any discussion? Again, any objection? If not, none. Motion passes. Can these be combined into one motion on the floor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Senator Atkinson, will you carry? Senator Atkinson will carry. That concludes the work of the committee at this time. We may be meeting again this afternoon. As soon as I know a time, I will make sure that your offices are informed. It will not be a very long meeting, probably.